on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, dreamers of dreams, Christmas people. Good morning, elves. Good morning to the Christian phobiacs. What are they called? People who are afraid of Christians. Good morning to you. Good morning to our guest host who is not in studio yet, but hopefully he's on the way. It's snowing here. Mark Riley, of course, is in England for another week. He had the big 2-week vacation out in England. I guess I'm assuming that he made it over there all right. Very frightened of flying, but apparently he did fine, and he's over in England today or later. Hopefully, if everything works out well, it is snowing here. So our guest host, who is Mark Danner, he's a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine and author of Torture and Truth: America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, will be sitting right across from me momentarily, within a half an hour, if he can get through the snow. It's snowing a little bit. I'm sitting here in a studio by myself, except with Kayla. Kayla's on the board. Nice to see you. Did you have a good Christmas there?
I had an okay Christmas. Nothing great.
How come it's always so disappointing? Dude, I was in California, man. I went to visit my house. I hadn't been there in a week. I hadn't been there in months. And I'm there for a whole week. And it's weird because, like, I get there, it's my house. All my stuff is there. I'm up on the roof. I'm getting the leaf blower. I'm blowing the leaves off the roof so they don't pick up pockets of water and rot through my ceiling.
You're very handy, aren't you?
Well, you know, I like to feel that way. I went out and bought myself a ladder. I was sweeping up leaves, doing the broom thing, buying presents for my wife, sitting out on the back stoop watching her put things into the garden.
Ah, good for you.
It was very nice, except that I don't live there anymore. There's only one problem, Chris. I have a house that I visit occasionally and a wife that lives there in it. And I get back here and I come home last night. And the difference between, you know, being here and being there is mind-blowing. Like, I saw my neighbors. My neighbor lives in the house over there. You wave to him. You say, hi, how you doing? Good. Merry Christmas. Mm-hmm. Happy holidays. Whatever. All right, here's a bottle of wine. Nice to see you. I come home to Queens, man. I walk into the hallway, dude. And I am greeted by my super. I'm greeted by the owner of the building who's doing work because he's moving his dentist office into the building because it's cheaper to live. He's got a dentist office. He's a Dominican dentist. There's no reason to qualify that, but it's better for the character. Dominican dentist. Carlos, great guy. And I got Louis the super, who doesn't speak any English. Right when I walk in with my wife who's visiting for Christmas, for the New Year, mm-hmm. They're like, have you seen a woman who lives next door to you? And I'm like, no, I haven't seen her in a while. And I just got back. I've been away for a week. They're like, well, no one's seen her. But here's the deal. You know, this woman who I get her mail sometimes, she's been in there alone for a long time. And I hadn't seen her, but it was unusual not to see her, you know. Now I'm freaking out a little bit, and I'm like, no, I haven't seen her. I mean, and here's what Carlos says. He says, she doesn't answer her door. No one's seen her in weeks. So we turned the electricity off.
What?
He turned her electricity off to see if that would ferret her out, I guess.
Because who does that?
I know. He figured that, you know, if she's not responding to the door, maybe she'll respond to the lights. It was sad.
Did he light the apartment on fire?
No, I don't.
Did she smoke her out?
She's a sad story. You know, she used to get her Social Security checks, and I would get her mail for her sometimes, but apparently she doesn't have any family. And I'm home for an hour, Chris. I'm home for an hour. Next thing you know, I go out to pick up Thai food with my wife. We're coming back. The cops are at the front door of the apartment. I let them in.
Oh, no.
I take them downstairs, right? And they come up. They got to go through my apartment to get out on the stoop to go into the window. And sure enough, the poor woman had passed away. And I don't know how long she'd been over there or what have you. But it was quite a scene. I'm just saying that within an hour, I got my three wild cats who haven't seen me, no longer know me, will not come out of the office. The woman next door has passed away, and you know, I'm sitting there, you know, having Thai food, just sort of, you know, watching the snow starting to trickle down. I'm going, I don't even know what the implications of it all is, Chris. I don't know what I'm trying to say here. And then my wife, I'm going to bed. She goes, I think your building's haunted. And I'm like, I don't need that. It's not haunted. It's the life of a building in Manhattan.
Just because a woman died, that the house is haunted?
Well. The woman upstairs for me, you know, was lost in 9/11. And then, like a few years ago, the woman who used to dress in the nun's outfit that wasn't a nun jumped off the building. But I don't think that had anything to do with the building.
No, I mean, like if an apartment building is haunted, that means that, like, people are dying from, like, objects falling on them. And
right, the building
stuff.
Is eating them.
Yeah, but, you know, people die all the time.
Yeah,
you know?
No.
They just happen to live in your apartment building.
Oh, it's just so sad. And I had this this woman who, a friend of my wife's and I, was staying at the apartment, this girl who watched our apartment.
Yeah.
She's allergic to cats, and I got these three horrible cats.
Why would you do that to
her? She wanted to, you know? And anyway, so I did have a good time in Los Angeles, but I tend to like sitting around doing nothing. I like just hanging out. I bought my wife an iPod and many things.
Nice.
What'd you get? Did I tell you? I already talked about what I got her before we left. I got her an iPod. I got her Grand Theft Auto San Andreas.
Yeah.
I got her a facial and a massage.
Oh, that's nice.
I got her the Tower, the last Lord of the Rings movie with the whole box and the toy and the whatever the hell it is. You know, I got her everything. And then I realized that there's a word for what my wife is. She's an adolescent. Is that what it's called? Adolescent? Someone who is a grown-up but acts like an adolescent?
I don't know.
You don't know? How do you not know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. That sounds right. Yes.
But then, of course, within seconds, she's loaded up her iPod with a million songs. And I'm sitting there. I can't even bring my CDs back. I haven't mailed them back. And I got to get one. You have one, right? You're
yeah,
potted.
I love it.
All right.
And what kind did you get her?
A guy with a good one.
Like 40 gigabytes.
You're talking to a guy that bought a $500 vacuum cleaner.
That's true.
You think I'm going to hold back? I bought her the 40 gig that, you know, but no pictures. No, does yours do pictures?
No, mine doesn't. I got an earlier model.
All right, so let's you know, I guess I should talk, you know, we should start with the news. I just wanted to, you know, regroup and say hello to all the beautiful listeners out there who enjoy our show on a daily basis. Thank you for all the nice emails about the work we put into creating those best ofs. We didn't just do the standard best ofs. We did sort of, you know, new stuff. I got one bit of email, of course, right when I get here. I just poking around the email, and somebody had listened to our Judy Gold interview and got mad at me, called me latently homophobic.
What?
Yeah, because I asked Judy if she'd ever had a threesome. And for some reason, this just ticked off some woman who said, why do you assume just because Judy's a lesbian that she would have a threesome? And then why do you assume that all things, you know, require men? And first of all, to be honest with you, I wasn't assuming that it was a man. So, I mean, who's, you know, more latently screwed up, me
exactly.
or this woman? I assume that maybe they bring someone else in. And then she says, why do all people assume that so much of gay identity is based on sexuality? Oh, I don't know, because it is. I mean, and then she's like, would you ask that of your straight friends? Yeah, after a certain point, of course it was. I don't have any friends. Do you have any friends, Chris, that you haven't said, have you ever had a threesome?
No, I've asked.
Of course.
I've asked tons of people.
Of course. And they always say, no. Except that once, but it didn't work out that good.
Yeah, it never ends out great, you know.
But then she got all mad at me. It's like, I don't care how many gay friends you have. She said, you know, deep down, you know, you're judgmental. Well, yeah, because it's not judgmental, but it's a different lifestyle than the one I lead. So why wouldn't I be a little curious, a little interested, you know, a little, prodding? You know, I mean, you know, it's not that I'm afraid of it, but it is different to me. So I was curious. And she, you know, she said what she said. So this is horrible. There is a tsunami, and in response to these earthquakes that are going on, 20,000 people were killed, and this is like hit so many different areas, you know, ranging from, you know, India to Indonesia, and like we're gonna talk about it more in depth after the break. But I tell you, you know, if this kind of thing happened here, it always amazes me when something like this happens in a different country, in India or in China or somewhere. I don't know if it's because of architecturally or the structures of the buildings or the way cities are designed or what that so many people are tragically killed in these type of disasters. I think a lot of it has to do with just population mass and the way buildings are constructed. But it's just horrible what is going on over there. It's almost 20,000 people maybe dead in these earthquakes and these tsunamis. We'll talk about it a little more when we come back after this. You're listening to Air America Radio. It's 15 past the hour.
Morning Sedition. Delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. On Air America Radio.
Twenty. 20 past the hour. Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. Our special guest co-host today, Mark Danner, just showed up, and he's being debriefed. Is that what you call it? He's in from the storm, and he's talking to P.W. McDonald in the booth. That laugh you heard was none other than Dan Pashman, who is going to do some reporting here in just a second. Because can I do the pump pilot first?
It's actually the next
segment. Is it actually the next
segment?
Yeah. Well, you know, I used to know how to do this show before I left.
That's all right.
So apparently, from what the news that I'm looking at,
yeah.
Like five or six countries were hit by. Can I be honest with you, Dan?
Please.
My biggest fear in life when I was like 5 to 11 years old was
right.
A tidal wave. It wasn't even an earthquake. It was the idea of a tidal wave. I lived in Alaska for 2 years in the late 60s.
Wow.
My father was stationed up there briefly when he was in the Air Force, so Anchorage, Alaska, and that was in 69. So they had a huge earthquake there, I think in 63 or 64, one of the biggest in this country. And there was all this rubble.
Right.
You could go visit these mounds of rubble. And just the talk of the tidal waves, in my head, that was the most frightening thing that could ever happen in the world. And clearly, there's a reason for that fear.
Absolutely. It's pretty scary stuff, really. I mean, some of these people were literally, I mean, this thing hit a swath of the earth that is kind of almost unimaginable. It was created by an earthquake underneath the floor of the Indian Ocean. And it immediately, speeding away from the epicenter, waves began forming. The waves were moving 500 miles an hour.
So it was in Indonesia, Thailand. So 500 miles an hour, I guess that would take out any building. I mean, I guess I wasn't trying to be condescending,
right,
but when I was saying that, you know, a lot of times the death tolls in some of these countries are higher because of the way, you know, cities are structured, but 500 miles per hour could probably take out any building.
And it also just, this thing, these people had no warning. There were people sitting out sunbathing on the beach.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden,
bam,
washed away.
Really?
Yeah.
So they were just laying there, and the earthquake happened underwater, so there was no way they could feel where they were? Is that what you're telling me?
It swept people and fishing villages out to sea.
Oh, my God.
Millions were displaced from their homes, and thousands were missing, and the death toll has mounted. I came in here, I've been here since 2 a.m. The death toll was about 13 or 14,000 when I arrived at work. We're now seeing 20,000 only a few hours later. And that number is expected to increase dramatically.
Indonesia, India, Malaysia, Maldives,
mm-hmm.
Myanmar, Bangladesh, and Somalia. That's 3,000 miles away in Africa. They could feel that.
3,000 miles away.
Well, you can feel earthquakes. Like even when I was in that last big earthquake in Los Angeles.
Right.
It was horrifying. It was horrifying, but, you know, it lasted about 40 seconds. Right, and then, like, it goes away. It was the middle of the night. I was laying in bed in a hotel because I was there on some sort of press thing.
Right.
And, you know, the first thing you hear are things on the wall shaking. And then you hear, you know, you feel your bed moving. And then you literally feel the plates of the earth shifting. And it is the most powerless feeling that you could ever imagine. Because you're like, you have that moment where, like, I can just go, where? Where are you going to go? The earth is shaking.
Right.
What are you going to do? You just want to get outside. And then there's that moment where you're like, should I put on pants? You know, I don't want to. What if you go outside and you're the only guy out there with no pants? You know, that would be sad. And then, like, you go outside. But then there's also that moment where I'm like, after it stopped, I was like, well, I can just, you know, crash.
Right.
Go back to bed. But then there's reverberations. And
scary.
You can feel them for weeks sometimes. Those were felt in San Francisco for, like, weeks afterwards.
And just to put this in perspective, Mark, take the Los Angeles example. This would be like if there was an earthquake in Los Angeles and we felt it in New York.
That's true.
3,000 miles away.
Why can't they just call it another earthquake at that point? Why is it?
Seriously.
I mean, if it's all the way over there, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
But it is awful, and there are things that you can do if you want to. We've immediately put up some links on our site to help. For aid and to help victims of this earthquake that's ongoing.
Yeah, just go to the links page on morningsedition.com, and we have several links up there of aid organizations if you want to try to help out.
Man, I can't even believe walls of water that big, and you see it on TV, and it's just like, it's just awful. And that on top of the, you know, the woman next door passing away and the snow, it's just a very haunted morning for me.
Yeah, well, it's going to be okay. We're going to stick together.
Well, how was your Christmas?
My Christmas was great. The Christmas Day was a legendary eating day in Pashman family history.
Oh, yeah.
At no point were we not either eating a meal or preparing a meal.
Yeah, I felt kind of bad about the. It was almost like right when I got home, I started this eating experiment. I literally was like, I'm going to continue eating you know, for a week. And I, now I feel awful about it. You don't feel any shame, any badness about it?
I just feel very full. That's really it. You know, but no, I mean, I don't really feel shame usually when I eat a lot. I feel okay about it, you know. Yeah. It's like, sometimes I'll hit that wall where I'm just, it's more when I feel the physical pain of having eaten too much that I kind of be like, geez, I should have, like, slowed down. Maybe that slice of apple pie was a mistake.
Yeah. I just get to this point where someone came over the other night when it was like after Christmas Day. My wife's sister came over with her boyfriend who owns a restaurant. They brought two boxes, like a pumpkin cheesecake, regular cheesecake, chocolate covered cannolis, and I was done. I'd filled up. I'd already eaten the cookies. I'd already done everything I could. But I sat there and I ate half of everything. Everything. I stuffed myself with cheesecake and I just laid in bed and just. I went right from cheesecake to suicidal ruminations. Is that a side effect of cheesecake? Should it be in the box?
You should have told them to put some Xanax in the cheesecake.
I think that was one of them, the Xanax cheesecake. But it didn't work, man.
It was between the chocolate and the pumpkin. But here's my question for you. In that situation, you know, when people bring food to you, are you eating like, cause there's sort of an obligation there. To be like, oh, thank you for bringing this. I will eat it now.
I sort of think about that all the time. I think about what I'm obligated to do and what I allow myself to do just because I can. Because even in restaurants, all of a sudden, they give you way more than you need.
Right.
But you think because it's on the plate, you're entitled.
Right.
Yeah. Why not eat all of it? I can't believe we're talking about this, but it's very important during the holidays, the food thing.
Absolutely. Food is a major focal point during the holidays.
I could use some food right now. When's the new intern coming in?
I don't know, but I actually haven't even... Mark, you know how I am with my meals. I'm like clockwork around here, all right? I don't miss a meal. I don't miss chance for a meal. I'm an hour late on my lunch.
I didn't see you.
I'm so full.
I didn't see the Pashman wrap bag coming.
The wraps are still in the fridge because I was so full in recovery from this weekend that I haven't been hungry yet.
Well, we've got a lot of stuff coming up. Mark Danner's going to be out here in the next segment. We're going to get into the Ukrainian election. Yushchenko declares victory today or yesterday. We're going to get into the American election a little bit. We're going to talk to him about about foreign policy and also about the upcoming Iraqi election, if that's possible, if that's going to happen.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think they're going to have a quote-unquote election. They'll have an election day and they'll drop the balloons and say, yay, we had an election.
Yes.
But whether or not it's going to have any legitimacy whatsoever, I think is a serious question.
I have a hard time understanding, like we were talking about before we got on the air, about the Sunnis protest, that the Sunnis are the minority,
right,
and they ran the country for a long time, but they're protesting, and they say they might not take part in the election, which on the surface doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because what would the minority stand to gain by pulling themselves out?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the real question, though, is anything they can do to break away the legitimacy of this election is going to hurt the process.
We'll be back with Mark Danner at Air America, 28 past the hour.
On Air America Radio.
We're back. It's 34 past the hour. I am Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. If you want to help the victims of the tsunami in Asia, go to the links page on morningsedition.com to see what you can do. We posted that stuff earlier today. If you want to blog, go to morningsedition.com and get on board. If you want to email sedition@airamericaradio.com. Today, our special guest host has made it. He snowshoed over here. Not really. Our special guest host today is Mark Danner. He's staff writer at New Yorker Magazine and author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, which is available on our website through morningsedition.com. So what happened, Mark? You just got in from Florida at 3 in the morning?
I did. Late flight from Florida. People sleeping in the airports down there.
What happened? Was it backed up that much? Was it just a weather thing?
It's a weather thing. It was because of... There were rumors throughout the airport that Kennedy Airport was closed, which, thank goodness, was not true. But the flights left rather late.
And was all packed out? I'm so glad. I haven't had to deal with that kind of craziness.
Yes. You're very lucky then. Not a good time to be on a plane.
Yesterday, the biggest crisis I had yesterday, I left L.A., and we were leaving, and I had an 8 o'clock flight at LAX coming into JFK, and right as we were leaving, one of my cats got out, so we had to go through a half an hour of trying to get the cat in, which we couldn't get in. Then we get in the car, and we almost missed the plane. It was ridiculous. There was no parking lots. I had to park the car at Marriott, get on a Marriott shuttle, and I just, you know when you get so stressed out that all you can do is surrender and enter that weird paralysis of like, well, whatever happens is going to happen. I'm screwed either way. I call that spirituality.
I definitely know that feeling. Yes, I call that a spiritual awakening. Thank goodness I had no feline problems yesterday at all, but airline I did.
So now we're getting this news in about Viktor Yushchenko, who has gone through a tremendous amount of, he's a very courageous guy, you know, to stand up. I mean, they tried to kill him. And, you know, and there was enough public outcry about the results of that election in that country that, you know, they literally had to buckle and do the right thing and have these new elections. And it looks like he got what he deserved.
Yes, it's incredible. The exit polls show him nearly 20% ahead. The official results say he's about 4 or 5 points ahead. But I think those images of his face have been seen so widely around the world, the kind of before and after pictures that show the poisoning apparently with dioxin. Have given this election such worldwide currency. Everyone knows about it. And, of course, Yushchenko at a certain point had to campaign with a shunt in his back that delivered directly to his spine opiates to kill the pain because he was in such intense pain all the time from this poisoning, which apparently was some variety of dioxin.
It's just old school kind of, you know, horrible assassin weirdness. I mean, here, you know, they nailed Kerry for, you know, using Botox, but there they literally, you know, poisoned this guy with dioxin.
That's true. I mean, it really brings you back to the darkest times of the Cold War, when I'm sure your listeners will remember the fellow who in London was poisoned with ricin. An umbrella tip was in a crowd as he was waiting to cross a bridge. An agent pushed the tip of an umbrella into his leg, which delivered this little pellet of ricin and killed him. That was at the height of the Cold War in the 1980s. And this seems to take us back. You know, the notion that this guy has dinner one night with the security chiefs of Ukraine. He comes home. His wife kisses him and detects a distinct medicinal flavor in his mouth. The next morning, he becomes ill. Within a couple of days, he is so ill he can't stand up, has to fly in some emergency to Vienna. They can't figure out what in the world is wrong with him. They find all sorts of tumors in his stomach and his intestines, and his face begins to take on not only a gray color, but all of these cysts and boils and all the rest of it. And he continues throughout campaigning. And even though he's declared to have lost, his supporters take to the streets. And they are so insistent, and apparently the evidence of fraud is so blatant that the Ukrainian Supreme Court is led to declare the election null and void, which is astonishing. It's never happened before, and here we are again.
In a couple examples of this in the Ukraine, many state employees suspected of being opposition sympathizers were forced to hand in their absentee ballot certificates to their bosses, which were used for pro-Yanukovych voters to use multiple certificates to bus to polling stations. From station to station, enabling them to vote several times on election day. That was just one of the frauds. But it's very similar to some of the stuff we're hearing about the American elections. You know, especially in 2000, a purge list in Florida disenfranchised over 50,000 voters who were mostly African American and Hispanic descent.
Yeah.
I mean, these kind of tactics, though they're a little more brutal, a little more blunt, and a little more old school in the Ukraine, you know, some of the similar things, you know, definitely occurred in the last two American presidential elections.
Yes. Well, you know, you're reminded by this that there are all sorts of ways to deflect the results of the people in an election, from discouraging people to vote outright, which was done in Florida, of course, in 2000, to trying to suppress voter turnout in other more subtle ways. And then actually in the blatant way it was done in Ukraine to actually throw out the results of election, you know, actually throw out ballots, which was done on a very broad scale in Ukraine, which did not happen here in quite that way.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Ballots were more obviously discarded and were not counted.
Well, it's easier when they're on paper to throw them away and not just in some sort of chip or in the mind of a machine.
That's true, and we should remind listeners that Al Gore was not, so far as we know, poisoned with the dioxin.
No.
We don't know what the matter was, but there was no dioxin poisoning that we know about.
Also in the Ukraine, pro-Yanukovych thugs were sent to polling sites to intimidate and beat Yushchenko voters. All right, but in 2004, the Republican Party here paid 3,600 recruits to disrupt voting in Cleveland, Dayton, and other Ohio cities with the aim of challenging voters in predominantly African-American and other working-class neighborhoods. Like, you can't just go beating people up.
That's right.
They got to figure out more, devious and intelligent ways of denying people their right to vote.
That's true. It was a little more subtle. I mean, you actually had a court fight leading right up to Election Day that was finally decided on Election Day about whether or not people could challenge voters' bona fides within the polling stations, and that, of course, was finally decided in favor of the Republicans
in Ohio. Yeah, and dig this. In the Ukraine, witnesses say that acid was poured into ballot boxes in pro-Yushchenko parts of the country. Also, some voters, dig this, Kayla, some voters were given pens filled with ink that disappeared, leaving ballots unmarked and invalid. The old disappearing ink thing. Like, they probably got it from Acme Novelty House. You know, they just ordered a box of disappearing ink pens. In 2000, then some voters in Palm Beach County, in Florida, the now infamous and confusing butterfly ballots caused some Gore voters to accidentally vote for Reform Party candidate Pat Buchanan. But that's no invisible ink. Man, just here you go. Use this pen. What the?
I just came this morning from Palm Beach. That's where I was, the scene of the crime.
And you got family down there?
I do. My parents are there during the winter. And, of course, that affected, the famous butterfly ballot affected about 3,400 Gore voters who voted for Buchanan. But up north in Jacksonville, you had about 27,000 votes thrown out from the infamous but less well-known Caterpillar ballot. Which was also a very confusing ballot, and in which 27,000 votes, mostly those of African Americans, were thrown out because they marked two pages, and the instructions had said mark every page, and if you did in fact mark every page, your ballot was discarded.
You got to explain to me this Caterpillar ballot when we come back. I also want to talk to you about your piece that I just read. Where was that published about this year's presidential election?
In the New York Review of Books. The New York Review of Books. It's called How Bush Really Won.
Yeah, because we want to get into that because we his inauguration is coming up. I have his Palm Pilot in front of me that was just delivered to me, earlier before you got here by Ramon, who was. It's snowing out. I don't know why he was wearing shorts, but here we go. Here's George Bush's Palm Pilot for today, 9 a.m. Wake up in Crawford, day one of grueling post-vacation vacation. Note, vacations are hard work. 11 a.m., make notes for inaugural speech. Note, 6 or 7 minutes should be plenty. It's not like you have to run again. 12 a.m., plan second term agenda. Note, find new fun thing that half of America loves and ban it. Must keep base energized. 1 p.m. Call Yushchenko to congratulate him. Tell him the first stolen election is always the sweetest. 2 p.m. Make resolutions for 2005. 1. Eliminate any residual listening to others. Quote unquote. Okay. 4 p.m. Find out if any Halliburton equipment was damaged in that tsunami thing. And 9 p.m. Test multi-billion-dollar blame defense system. Note, it only takes one to bring this whole thing down. There you go. That's today's Palm Pilot. We'll be back with Mark Danner. After this, we're going to go into his piece that he wrote for the New York Review of Books on, how Bush won this election. And we'll talk a little bit more about the Ukraine and the upcoming Iraqi election. It's 43 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. I am Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. Our special guest
co-host today is Mark Danner. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's still Mark and Mark. Mark Riley.
I thought that was why I was asked.
Yeah, that's the only reason. Yeah, next 3 days we've got other Marks coming in. No, actually,
excellent.
Mick Foley will be in tomorrow, and the next day Mark Riley is in England on vacation with his family. His wife is from England. Mark Danner, of course, the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror, which is available for purchase through morningsedition.com. I heard you scratching your beard on Mike. That was very good. You need a shave, Mark.
I wanted to give your listeners a real sense of being here.
So we were talking a little bit about the Ukrainian elections, about Yushchenko, rising above incredible obstacles and actually creating a social momentum that enabled justice to be done. You know, unlike this country in the eyes of a lot of people, what do you think happened in terms of the last presidential election? I know you just wrote this big piece because I just read most of it before we got on the air here. It was sent to me this morning. How do you think it unfolded? Because what I'm noticing now, outside of potential fraud or whatever went on in Ohio, that it's amazing to me how little how intense the climate of fear was before we went into the election. Just how many terror alerts, how they coincided with Bush in trying to cover stuff up, how they used terror and fear and the lie of the connection between Iraq and the terrorists to create a momentum based in fear among the voting populace of this country. And in your piece, you sort of explore that a little deeper.
Absolutely. The main thesis really in the piece is that though the election has now been presented as a kind of upsurge in concern about moral values, mm-hmm. that everybody is interpreting it really from the moment it was clear that Bush had won a victory as an affirmation of moral values of the red states coming back and saying voting for apple pie, motherhood, God, and against the gays and gay marriage. In fact, the election was really about fear. If you look at the advertising, if you look at even the exit poll results, you find out that the main concern was the war on terror, as the famous Wolf ad, Wolf Circling ad said, Kerry will not protect us. Are we able to take that risk? It was all about pinning on Kerry's head the notion that he would leave America vulnerable. And this election was so important because America faced horrible enemies. And if you look around the country and look at the real results, this was an election fought on a fulcrum of fear. Not only if you look at the advertisements itself, but if you look at the results of exit polls and all the other evidence we have, the idea was gin up the fear on the part of the American people. And not only was this crucial to getting people to vote for Bush, to not taking a risk on someone new, but also to getting people to come out and vote. Because, of course, the story of this election was that 11 million new Republican voters came out and voted for Bush, and 8 million new voters came out and voted Democratic, voted for Kerry. But the Republicans had enormous success in turning out the people, and the major motivator for that was fear. Fear not only of a terrorist attack, but fear also of how Kerry could leave the United States more vulnerable instead of protecting the country the way Bush had done. That was the theme that the Republicans put forward, and they did it with the help of very frightening radio and television ads.
Of course, and isn't it amazing to you that, first of all, the one thing I liked about the piece was that, we got to keep hammering on the fact that he doesn't have a mandate. This was not some sort of landslide. There are plenty of people in all of these red states that voted against Bush, and even in the piece, I think you cited that, his approval rating is starting to slip again, and that, most of what he was basing his, arguments of fear on were lies. And, what is it about when you look at, the truth of that, just how many people voted on this gut instinct of just, wanting to keep things the same is basically what you're saying, even in light of the fact that, most of the policies that that this administration stands behind alienates a good part of the people that voted for them. I mean, what does that say about people's, ability to get information, ability to seek the truth? How successful, clearly is this, the propaganda campaign has been overwhelmingly successful,
It has been overwhelmingly successful. I mean, you find out, there's a report done a couple weeks before the election on the different realities of Kerry and Bush voters that basically finds out the great majorities of Bush voters believe that weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq, believe that Al-Qaeda and Saddam have been proved to be allies, that their close connections proven to them. That proves essentially that Bush voters believe all sorts of things that are demonstrably untrue and that have been shown to be untrue in the press. The amazing thing about this to me, as you said a minute ago, is that the election historically was extremely narrow. I did a chart in the piece which shows sitting Republican presidents and their margins of victory. And if you look at it from, 1904 with Theodore Roosevelt through Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, all the way up to George W. Bush, you see these margins of victory, which start with Roosevelt 17%, then Eisenhower 16%, Nixon 23%, Reagan 18%, and then Bush 2%. And it's even more pronounced on the electoral vote side, 196, 384, 503, 512, and then Bush 34. So one of the remarkable things about this election was, for an incumbent, it was an incredibly narrow election. He basically squeaked by.
Let's talk about how the election system is structured, because even right now, as we speak in Washington, that, why is it constantly breaking down? I mean, in the sense that in Washington that the Republicans are bullying recounts over and over again, and because they think that they can, by doing that, they will eventually get the numbers they want or force them to have a reelect. And even, Republicans that supported the candidate that lost in Washington are saying, look, he lost. The Democrat, she has won.
Right.
And what needs to change in your eyes in terms of this electoral system to make this function more properly?
Well, a lot needs to change is the short answer. I mean, the fact is we're 4 years after the 2000 enormous breakdown, the perfect storm, in which a candidate who got 540,000 fewer votes than his opponent, one came to power, and very little has been done to change it. You have outmoded voting machines. You have recount procedures that are not standardized around the country. You have all sorts of things that break down in our elections.
Isn't it safe to say that the reason they didn't change this time around is that it helped the Republicans?
Absolutely.
And now these triad machines that aren't the paperless machines, but they're punch card machines, are now saying that there was problems with those counts, and there are still people that we're trying to fight to get a recount in Ohio that would shine some light on the type of fraud that was
absolutely.
Going on.
It's a great point. I was in Jacksonville on election day, this election day, as I was last time. And the amazing thing is there was a huge outpouring in Florida of Democratic voters, and it seemed to everybody on the ground that the Democrats had won. When the results started coming in late that night to show the Republicans were up, people said, well, my God, these numbers downstate, which is the Democratic stronghold, seem very low. What do we do about this? This doesn't seem credible. And, of course, it slowly dawned on everybody in the room that this time you couldn't check the machines because the machines can't be checked. The touchscreen machines leave no record.
Crazy. This is the liberal agenda from today from the Streisand compound. She had to take a week off with all the premiere of the new Bacher movie. All right, so since you just got a new PlayStation, send your old one to needy kids in the Sudan. Two, blame the Bush administration for the sudden high unemployment rate among department store Santas. Three, trim Christmas tree into topiary protest sculpture. All right. Four, attend meeting of CCC, Christians Against Christ at Christmas. Sorry, Xmas. Five, today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. Santa was a black lesbian. You do know that, don't you? Wake up, man. How clear does it have to be? We'll be back more with Mark Danner. We're going to have John Perkins, who spent 10 years building up America's empire and then wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, will be with us. Jeff Jarvis later in the show, and much more here on Air America Radio.
Edition on Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark.
Mark Maron here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, dreamers of dreams, all people who are happy or sad. Oh, man, it's trickling away. Where's my list of adjectives and metaphors and names to call people? My guest host today is Mark Danner. He's staff writer at New Yorker Magazine. He's the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, which you can get on our website at morningsedition.com. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mark. It's good to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you here. So you were in Florida over the holidays for the whole week? Or?
I was. No, just for the past couple of days.
Palm Beach County, yes.
That was my limit. Yes, my parents are down there during the wintertime.
Two-day limit.
That's right. I think that's a good rule to follow.
I avoided mine entirely.
That's a little more extreme. Not everybody can quite get away with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, mine are in different places, and I hadn't been home for so long. I just wanted to go home and hang out there with my wife. I went to Disneyland.
Yeah, I know.
It seems odd. You know, I mean, Brendan P. Devin McDonald, one of our producers, went to Disney World, actually went there on purpose for the week a couple weeks ago. But I was home. My wife, who is, from what I understand, an adolescent is the name for them. She's a grown-up who acts like a teenager, loves Disneyland, but she wanted to go to California Adventure. All right, that's the grown-up theme park where they have the porn across from... No, I'm kidding. Across from Disney. The porn rides. No, I'm kidding. But that's how they market it. It's like a more... The rides are a little more intense. And she wanted to go there. So we went there, and I went on a roller coaster that was insane. And I don't even know why I'm talking about this, because I'm not a roller coaster guy, but there was hardly anybody at the park. It was kind of slow. So there were actually kids who were like roller coaster addicts. They had a single line entry where if you're just a single rider, you could go into a certain area and they could get you right on. There were kids that were like just, you know, wild-eyed. They'd been on it 7 times. This thing shot up. There was a loop-de-loop. This is not the story I want to tell. But nonetheless, I went on it twice, and I could see how you could generate a small addictive problem with roller coasters. But... went over to Disneyland, and, you know, I'm usually very condescending. The other thing about California Adventure, they had a ride there called the Something Aviator. I don't remember what it's called, but it's their big ride where it's like a flight simulator. Oh, flying over California or something, and I got the distinct feeling. Did you ever see Soylent Green, the movie?
I did see it. Yeah, I did see it.
Do you remember when Edward G. Robinson goes to die, and they literally lay him down, and they show him a movie of what Earth used to be like?
Yes.
This is what it felt like, Mark. They were piping in smells. It was supposed to be like you're on an airplane and you're flying over. It's like this 360-degree cinema thing,
right.
And you're on this like a chairlift that moves as if a plane were moving. And then you're flying over orange groves, and they literally spray air freshener in there. Like all of a sudden you're like, what's that smell? And you're like, it smells like crappy air freshener. It's like, yes, it's oranges. Oh, okay, I guess that'll work, you know. But it really did feel to me like that moment in Soylent Green where Edward G. Robinson checks out.
It's great. You know, it doesn't matter if it all disappears. We can recreate it, so what the hell?
Exactly, but I found it to be very disappointing. After an hour and a half online, how did they sell that crap? How did they make people believe that it's okay to wait for an hour and a half online for a 5-minute ride? It was ridiculous, but I got to be honest with you. The roller coaster was definitely worth it.
Well, I think it's what being an adolescent is all about now. Now that we have the word, we can define ourselves accordingly.
Yeah, there's a lot of words, apparently, that means kidult, I think, is another one. But I did go to Disneyland. I saw the Christmas parade, the Disneyland Christmas parade, and they had, you know, the birth of Mickey. You know, Mickey in the manger is very touching and goofy. And I'm kidding. And I went on the Christmas version of It's a Small World, which I have to be honest with you, Mark, Kayla, whoever's in the booth listening, still the best ride at Disneyland. It's a Small World is the best ride at Disneyland. You're on it. There's never a line. It's like a 15-minute ride. And the sound quality, the sound design, the architecture of the sounds. Because you're on this little boat, and you see the dolls. You think it's silly, but it's kind of almost Swedish in its modern design. It's a very interesting-looking ride. But just the sound. If you were on mushrooms, all right, and you were in It's a Small World, I mean, it really literally feels like you're on mushrooms because, you know, you're moving through it on the boat, and you
you're just like, as you go into the different parts that represent different countries, it's just like one instrument will change. Like all of a sudden you're in the India part, and then all of a sudden it's a sitar. You're like, oh my God, did you just hear that? And then all of a sudden, no, it's a French horn from, you know, you're driving through, it's a tuba from Germany, whatever it is. It just, the sound texture changes as you're moving through this thing, and there's nothing else like it unless you've done natural hallucinogens. And I know some people get mad at me, Mark, for talking about drugs on the air, because I did do drugs in my life, and a lot of people are like, hey, you're living up to the stereotype that they're making of liberals, you know, you don't want to present yourself. It's like, you know, take it easy. Stop self-censorship, man. Go on, It's a Small World, and if you ever did mushrooms, you'll have a moment where you're like, wow, I remember when I did this on mushrooms, and it had nothing to do with it, being on a boat or dolls.
Natural flashback.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
a beautiful
and,
thing.
And if not, then you can just, but I do love that ride, and I actually got excited to go on it, and I'm just rambling on about Disneyland. Now let's talk about the real stuff that's going on in the world, Mark Danner.
What the hell? Let's make a shift here.
Now, you primarily, your book is about Abu Ghraib.
Yes. Yeah, it's about Abu Ghraib and you know, the events after it. And it includes not only a fair amount of writing on Abu Ghraib and what it meant and what led up to it, the context in the Iraq War, but also I'm very proud that essentially the American taxpayers have written or underwritten a great deal of the book, because a lot of it is these amazing documents that came out during the Abu Ghraib story, the so-called torture documents, many of which were either written by or solicited by our Attorney General Designate, Alberto Gonzalez. He's the man who's been chosen to be the top law enforcement official of the United States, and he's the guy who urged the president to withhold Geneva Convention protection from prisoners in Afghanistan, Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And he's also the guy who solicited the opinion that essentially made torture legal.
Right. It's only torture. You can only call it torture if the guy dies.
Basically, I mean, the level of pain has to be equivalent to major organ failure or death. And think about that for a minute. That leaves you an awful lot of leeway to hurt somebody very badly before it's considered torture. And I think most people wouldn't give you a definition of torture that says, you know, the pain has to be sufficient to major organ failure for it to be torture.
Now, you think this is going to come up in the confirmation hearing?
I think it definitely will come up in the confirmation
hearing. In what form?
Well, I think that some of the senators on the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, particularly Patrick Leahy, I have a feeling, and possibly Ted Kennedy, are going to bring this up and basically hold up the documents and say, you know, what were you thinking, Alberto Gonzalez, when you wrote these things? The problem is, I think within the Democratic Party, they've not quite decided how strongly to go after this. I think some.
What's wrong with Democrats? Why can't we make it? Why can't we make a decision like that? How could that be unclear, Mark?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think that question goes to the heart of what the Democratic opposition is going to be over the next 2 years and over the next 4 years. I mean, do you sit there and say, as some Democrats have been doing, look, this guy has the votes, he's going to pass, why fight like this? Or do you say, you know what?
Let's just
the next election is today.
Yeah.
The next election is tomorrow. The next election is every day until 2006 and every day until 2008. And if you say that, you say, all right, let Alberto Gonzalez, if he's going to pass, he's going to pass. But we are going to show him for what he is. We're going to show his record for what it is. You know, my view is that I think back on Harry and Louise. Remember the famous anti-healthcare policy run in the early 90s that led to the Republican takeover in 1994. I think there should be ads now put on by MoveOn.org and other organizations that connect Abu Ghraib, as it should be, to Alberto Gonzalez and let voters know.
Right.
Absolutely.
Show the picture.
Because this isn't a stretch. This is, he did write these things. I think the picture should be shown. I think if you're going to be in opposition, you ought to inform Americans about who this guy is and what it says about the Republican Party, that he's been nominated to be the top law enforcement official in the country.
Rewriting international law to allow fascist tactics on behalf of this country is not acceptable in a democratic nation. Neither is, you know, transcending or trying to get rid of the, you know, the Democratic Senate's ability to filibuster these court nominations.
Absolutely.
These are, you know, the Democrats should not go lightly around this stuff because they're being bullied, and I don't care what the language is. You know, this is their only power, and we got to talk about that when we come back. All right?
Absolutely.
All right, we're here with Mark Danner. It's 16 past the hour. We're going to deal with that, these new judicial nominations, after this on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My guest host is Mark Danner. He's the staff writer to New Yorker magazine, author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. Mark Riley, still on vacation in England, I'm sure, you know, going to soccer games, having a good time with his family until he has to fly back. Then he's going to be nervous. But we'll hear from him next week after the new year. Mark Danner, this is a little something I call my dream diary. We do this every day. I write down my dream from last night, so I share it with the people. Okay. I've been to therapy in 2 weeks, man. All right. I'm naked and hairy and disgusting and locked in a dark screening room watching Hell's Angels for the 500th time. Oh, crap. I'm Howard Hughes. Germs everywhere coming to get me. Things are not good. Not good. I'm saving my urine in neatly arranged milk bottles. I've got 50 bottles now, 5 more, and I could get an NEA grant. Germs, man. Germs are everywhere. I have to touch everything with 3 tissues. My fingernails are 6 inches long and brown and crawling with earthworms. I know. And I'm thinking, why don't I get to the part where Howard Hughes' wife is like, you know, where he's doing Ava Gardner. What happened to that part? All right, then Kayla walks into my sanctuary and says, hey, man, how was your week off? And I scream, ow, germs, no, germs. I cover my mouth and I double over in agony. And Kayla says, oh, yeah, cool. And he disappears. And I lay there in a paranoid stupor for 6 months and then stagger over to the corner and start to urinate into a milk bottle. There's a knock on the door. Who is it? Jesus. Can I come in? Not right now, Jesus. I'm busy whizzing into a milk bottle. How was your Christmas? Well, the usual. I ate too much. And all right, I'll come back later. Just then, Bernie Carrick bursts in with flowers and champagne and says, start the party, ladies. Daddy's here. Aye. And I'm just like, no, germ, stop. Luckily, Ava Gardner shows up in a low-cut gown and grabs Bernie by the collar. Beat it, loser, she says, and tosses him out a window. She turns to me with her smoky eyes. Come on, Stinky. Let's get out of here. Ah, germs. I woke up and my bed was filled with surgical masks. Dude, that was like the weirdest dream I've had in months. That was too much. Did you see
that
movie?
Exactly the same dream last night. I can't believe it.
Did you see that movie?
I was stunned.
Yeah. Did you see The Aviator?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
You got to see it. It was really a good film, I thought. I'm sort of a tough sell, and Kent the Colonel Jones, he'd come in here raving about it, and I was skeptical as to whether or not DiCaprio could pull it off.
Yeah.
And he pulled it off, man. I mean, he pulled it off. It made me very happy. All right, so let's get to this renomination of the 20 judgeship, the judicial nominees. What does this mean, Mark Danner? Explain it to me, because I'm kind of a moron when it comes. These are renominations, which means they were put up before shot down, and now there's a couple of things at stake here. Is that, you know, Bush is obviously trying to force these guys through because these are the judicial nominations he wants. They were filibustered once before, and then you got Bill Frist, who's trying to eliminate the filibuster ability by getting Dick Cheney to say, no, we can do it this way. We just need a majority. We don't need 2/3 of the Senate to vote on this, and
exactly.
He can just do that. But yet there's enough, we're just relying on the respect of the Senate by certain Republicans to not allow this to happen?
That's right. I think what's going on here is they think of it, the Republican leadership thinks of this as a no-lose proposition. That is, you put some of these guys up, you know, on the one hand, it's possible that some of them will get through. That is, you can pick off some of the Democratic votes. Some Democratic senators get them to vote for it, break the filibuster and get them through. Or if the Democrats hold firm and prevent these guys from winning, then you have a platform on which to push through the so-called nuclear option, which is a way to essentially get rid of the filibuster, at least for judicial nominations.
Is it my understanding of the way this government was structured, the way this American democracy was built on paper, the filibuster is there as part of the checks and balances for when this particular situation happens? It is the only, you know, this is the only tactic they have. And for them to just override that and take it away, that is inherently, I don't know if it's unconstitutional, but it is certainly not within the way this government is supposed to operate.
Well, I think that's true. It's not unconstitutional. The thing isn't exactly, it isn't in the Constitution, so they can do it. On the other hand, it is traditional practice for which the Senate, you know, historically has had great respect. So this is a very, very, very important thing, very serious thing.
So now we're
going
to see how dirty some of these bastards are. That we're going to just see, you know, what kind of compromises they're willing to make for this administration.
Exactly, exactly. You'll see Republicans whether they're willing to go to the wall, as it were, for this administration. And also, you know, this is partly payback for the right wing, the radical right wing, and what they are thought to have given the president in this election.
So radical right wing, you're talking about the neocon death cults, Christo-fascist zombie brigades.
I couldn't have said it better.
Okay.
You know?
So it's not, these are not, the ideologically, these are the fanatical religious right.
Yes, absolutely. And this is a signal to them that, look, the president's reelected. He recognizes that you were there for him, that you came out and gave him the votes he needed to get through. And we are, the first thing we're going to do, even though the president is talking about civility in Washington, you know, bringing up the, making the political dialogue more civil, all the rest of it. In fact, the first thing he's doing is sticking an eye, sticking a stick, in the Democrats' eye. And he's doing it this way. So it's payback. And it's also, as I say, a no-lose proposition because they feel like either they can get some of these guys through or they can get rid of the filibuster. And that's still a controversial step for a lot of Republicans. But they can gin up support for it if they put Democrats in the position once again of blocking these nominations.
And now, do you think that now what has to happen? How does the nuclear option work? I mean, what would have to happen?
Well, the Democrats can basically decide to change it. So far as I understand, I mean, there's no actual legal procedure they have to go through. I think the caucus. I believe the caucus itself can make that decision within the as the majority. This is a rule thing. It's not a law,
right?
Which is the critical distinction here. And even though it's a rule that's been respected, you know, for more than 100 years, it is still a matter of a rule, not a law.
I can't believe that, you know, in this particular administration that we're now, you know, we have to rely on, you know, a certain amount of senatorial self-respect on behalf of certain Republicans.
Absolutely,
it's very disturbing to me.
Well,
Mark.
You know, it is disturbing. It's disturbing also to think that, you know, no matter how vituperative things have gotten over the years, over the last century, no matter how bitter it's gotten, still this thing has been kept in place.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everybody recognized that it served everyone's interests.
Okay, we'll be back with John Perkins with his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. That'll be very, very interesting. We also have Jeff Jarvis later in the hour. Stay with us. It's 28 past here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. I am Mark Maron. That's Mark Danner who's with me. Mark Riley still on vacation in England. Mark Danner, of course, is a regular writer for the New Yorker. His book is called Torture and Truth: America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, which is available on morningsedition.com. And it's nice to have you. You got
Thank
your
you.
Bagel.
You're
it's all
great
set.
To be. This is a great bagel. I think it's the best bagel I've ever had. Really?
Well, great.
I was on NBC once.
Big
their bagel
for
was
you.
Nothing compared to this. Compared to this bagel.
Well, we do something right. We know the place to get bagels.
This is a class outfit.
Oh,
I'm here to tell everybody.
Well, wait till you hear this guy. He's a regular caller to our show, and he's on the. I can see him on the line now. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone, once again, is Planet Bush correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. Now, I was listening, and I heard what you said about putting Mickey Mouse in the manger.
Yeah.
Now, okay?
Yeah.
We like to have our little jokes here.
Yeah.
That's going too far. All right? We agreed on that. I'm glad you were at Disneyland, though.
Yeah.
It'll cheer you up. It's the happiest place on earth.
It is.
It really is.
It's also disturbing in a way.
Well, all right. I wasn't disturbed, but perhaps you were.
He's very nice today, Lawton Small.
He really is.
So, look, you know, we got, you know, it is a holiday season.
Yes.
And I think it's a good time to bring up the subject of compassion, Lawton.
I love that subject, Mark, since we are living under one of the most compassionate presidential administrations in American history with George W. Bush. You know, W stands for weeping.
Oh, come on.
Wet tears of compassion.
No.
Well, springs just bubbling up.
Oh,
inside.
Come on.
Wistful.
No, come on. Come
West,
on. Come on. Really? Now, tell me.
Willy Wonka?
tell me this. Do you think that Donald Rumsfeld showed compassion for the families of soldiers who died in Iraq by having a machine sign condolence letters?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, look. Secretary Rumsfeld knows that nothing hurts a man's ability to be compassionate more than writer's cramp.
Oh, come on.
Naturally, he had a machine sign those for
him.
The only option, really.
Look, it's a little bit impersonal to express condolences in such a cold, mechanical way, Lawton.
Let me tell you something, mister.
Yes.
Mother Teresa did it all the time.
Come on.
It is a well-known fact that she never entered a leper colony without her signature signing machine.
That's,
you can look that up.
That's crazy.
Okay.
You're making
she
that
was
up.
Shifty.
That was, you're making that up.
What?
You're making...
Winter Wonder.
Wait a minute. What are you doing? Okay. What about the fact that President Bush never goes to military funerals? How about that? Do you call that compassionate?
Yes. Yes, Mark, George W. Bush is a wartime president,
yeah.
And he should not have to complicate his life with things like death and mortality.
That's crazy.
And while we're on the subject, I'd like to ask you a question.
What?
Why don't you show a little compassion for the president?
Oh, come on. That's not my job.
Mark,
I'm not going to do it.
Did you know
what?
That most funerals are held on weekends?
Okay.
Which is exactly when most of your NASCAR races, football games, and rodeos are broadcast.
That's ridiculous.
And yet you expect our president, who is a huge sports fan, to attend a military funeral, even if it misses the big game?
Oh, come
He's
on.
He's a man's man. You expect him to spend his precious Sunday afternoons how? Watching grown men celebrate every play, regardless of how mediocre, or holding hands with a bunch of grieving widows and orphans.
Now, this is a little...
Now, that's not a choice.
This is a little creepy.
Not
right?
A
okay.
Against
my better
judgment.
Against my better judgment.
Weasel.
I'm going to follow your line of logic and ask, couldn't he tape the games, Lawton? I mean, I'm sure he could never... I mean, he could probably not figure out how to do it, but I'm sure one of the Secret Service guys, they have a TiVo, don't they?
If you punch me, do I not feel that punch in my rib?
I don't
even
know.
That is so insensitive. Have you ever taped a game to watch later? Do you spend all your time worrying someone's going to tell you the final score before you watch it, and everyone you know is talking about the game, so you got to go out of your way, make it a point that don't tell me the final score.
All
I'm going to watch it later.
Okay, I guess that happens, but I don't understand. What happened?
They can't resist talking about the game in some way. Ruined it for me.
Okay.
Oh, Lord. Oklahoma beat Texas. Did you see that?
Right.
Auburn beat Florida. Did I get to see that? No. Where's your compassion?
All right. Okay.
You talk about compassion. You got none.
All right, dude. It's okay.
I don't care about football.
Lord, it's okay,
some
man.
Some people love football.
Right, okay. I could see how it'd be. I could see how it'd be much more upsetting then. All right.
Hello.
You know, it's much more upsetting than young and men and women dying overseas. All right.
I'm in lots of
sure.
games. People ruin the game.
All right. Okay. All right, buddy.
you wouldn't tell me the score before I saw the game, would you? Because
no,
you're my friend, right?
I guess,
you're
man.
You're my best sports buddy, aren't you?
I guess, man. I guess. All right. Just take it easy, man. Take it easy. It's just a personal thing, apparently.
All right.
Okay.
Well, now, if you wouldn't tell me, neither would W.
All
his
right,
heart
right.
is as big as Texas.
All right, all right. I know.
Welcome home.
I saw that. Right.
We got a lot of football coming up. We're going to watch
okay.
it together, aren't
all
we?
All right. Thank you, Lawton. Thank
God
you.
God loves you.
Yeah, I
deal
know.
With it.
All right,
welcome home.
See you at Disney World.
Get that guy some help.
How do you like that? All right, right now, I'm excited to talk to our guest. Thank you, Lawton, by the way, if you're still listening. It's always engaging. Right now, I just want to read a bit from this jacket cover because this guy, covertly recruited by the United States National Security Agency and on the payroll of an international consulting firm, he traveled the world to Indonesia, Panama, Ecuador, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and other strategically important countries. His job was to implement policies that promoted the interest of the U.S. corporatocracy, and that was from 1971 to 1991. He worked for the international consulting firm of Chas T. Maine, where he was an economic hitman. Now he's the founder of and president of a non-for-profit environmentalist group, Dream Change. So he kind of came full circle. John Perkins is on the phone with us. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mark. Great to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. I'm always impressed to talk to people that, you know, that were so deeply submerged in the evil and then came out.
And I just want to know, what is an economic hitman?
Well, economic hitmen are really trained and very highly paid to go around the world and basically create a large empire. And we've done a very good job of it since World War II, and especially since the 70s until now. We do this in many different ways, but perhaps the most typical way is for us to identify third world countries that have resources that our corporations covet. Often these days that's oil. And we'll set up a deal between that third world country and a bank like the World Bank, whereby the bank lends that country a lot of money, billions of dollars, with the condition that most of that money will come back to our own country to corporations like the ones we all hear about these days, Bechtel and Halliburton. And this corporation will build big projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, things that primarily serve the very, very rich and often make the poorer more enslaved or even poorer. The debt that has been incurred in this deal is so great that the country can never repay it. So at some point, we go back to that country and say, look, you have a big debt. You owe us a lot of money. You can't repay us. Therefore, sell our oil companies your oil real cheap.
So that's a forced privatization situation. Is that how that works?
Yeah, you could call it that. It's really a double whammy because the country, we in the United States think we're giving these countries a lot of altruistic aid. In fact, most of that money is coming back to feed a few very wealthy people in our own country, the ones who own the Bechtels and the Halliburtons. And the country is getting a project that only its wealthiest people can use, and then is stuck in a position where it has to give its resources at a very cheap price to some other big international corporation, often at the expense of its rainforest, its environment, its indigenous cultures.
And at the expense of the people who are unable to make a living or incredibly poor.
Well, that's right. In fact, in order to try to pay back part of the debt, that means that the poor don't get social services, don't get education and health services and so forth.
So that just becomes part of the line is that, you know, part of the bottom line is that a lot of people are going to die because of these policies.
You're exactly right. In fact, today there's 24,000 people dying every single day from lack of nutrition, and 30,000 children die every day around the world because they don't get medicines that would save their lives. And a lot of that is the result of these policies.
So now what was the cathartic turn or the event that made you see the light? It seems that you've had an experience that was pivotal.
Well, Mark, the readers will see when reading the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, my life was a pretty glamorous one. And as I reread the book, I thought, my God, I'm not sure I would believe this if I hadn't lived this life myself. But every word of it is true. It is my life. It reads a little like a James Bond story.
Mm-hmm.
I had an amazing life and everything I dreamed about growing up poor in New Hampshire. And yet, all along, I knew that what I was doing was wrong. However, most of it wasn't illegal. And what I was doing, in fact, was lauded by some of my business school professors, people like Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank. So it was easy to justify what I was doing on one level, as we all justify a lot of things that we do that we know aren't quite right, like consuming too much fuel, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a very big level. I knew that what I was doing was wrong in my heart, and yet it was very easy to justify it. So I stayed in there until I had a very, I guess you'd call it euphemistic experience. Not euphemistic, euphoric.
Euphoric, yeah.
A little early in the morning here. A euphoric experience when I was sailing in the Virgin Islands. And at this point, I was about to become a millionaire in this job. And I had this experience sitting up on the ruins of this old slave plantation in St. John, Virgin Islands. And I realized that what I was doing was enslaving the world every bit as much as those plantation owners had brought slaves over from Africa. We're doing the same thing today around the world. And I knew that if I continued to do this, and made more and more money, I would get more and more trapped in the system, and that I had to get out. And so I went back to Boston and quit the next day I was in the office.
Wow, and you started up this foundation.
Yeah, well, it took me a while. I spent another 10 years kind of lingering around the fringes of economic hitmen. I formed a corporation that developed environmentally good alternative power plants. But I called in my cards and got a lot of favors for what I'd done as an economic hitman.
Okay, well, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to solicit a few calls at 866-303-2270 to talk about specific economic policies if people are interested, because You were involved in Indonesia, Panama, Ecuador, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Mark Danner's got a question for you when we come back. So we'll stay with us, will you, John, and we'll pick up. The book is Confessions of an Economic Hitman. We're talking to John Perkins. It's 45 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Call 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Nine minutes before the hour, our guest host today is Mark Danner. He's a staff writer at New York Magazine. He's the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. Our guest on the phone is John Perkins. The book is Confessions of an Economic Hitman. We were talking about some of the horrendous imperialistic policies that he was involved in different parts of the world. Mark Danner's got some questions for you. John?
I think these are fascinating. This is a fascinating subject because, of course, this is really about the real operation of American power. You know, when you actually see an intervention, a military intervention in Panama or Haiti or Iraq, that's when the usual operations of American influence have failed. So the way it usually happens, it seems to me, or the way John Perkins is describing. I wanted to ask, I covered Haiti for a number of years and still do, and I remember being struck when analyzing their foreign aid budget. You know, you hear again and again the U.S. is giving them X hundreds of millions of dollars. When you look at it, interestingly enough, the food aid, for example, which was a large part of that aid, turned out to be wheat that was being given by the American government to Haitians, which essentially destroyed their agricultural economy, which was based on rice, and made them dependent on the United States. I wonder if you know much about that particular operation in Haiti, but also more generally, whether that happens a lot around the world in foreign aid, that you try to destroy the indigenous agriculture or indigenous economy to make way for U.S. firms.
Mark, you bring up an incredibly good point, and I thank you for doing that. I was not personally involved in Haiti, but I am somewhat familiar with it, and what you're describing is very typical. The resource that Haiti offers us, perhaps the most important one right now, is it has the lowest minimum wage in the hemisphere, and it sort of sets the precedent for the other countries with low minimum wages like Ecuador and Bolivia, et cetera. And by taking away the subsistence farming and the production farming, the saleable farming, by bringing in wheat in that way, you force more people to go into that labor market. A lot of our big industries, including, for example, Disney, uses Haiti as a sweatshop to produce the goods that it sells in the stores and around the world. And one of the problems that Aristide had was that he suggested doubling the minimum wage in Haiti, which would now set a ripple effect throughout the hemisphere and create minimum wages to go up in many other places. A lot of the people I call the corporatocracy, the people behind this U.S. empire building, were very unhappy with that idea, and that's one of the reasons that Aristide fell into problems. I mean, there are many reasons, but that was one of them. And what you're describing, foreign aid is often used to actually cripple people rather than to help them. And what you said at the beginning is also fascinating because, yes, we've built the first truly global empire in the history of the world since World War II, and we've done it primarily through economics, not through the military. When we economic hitmen fail, which isn't very often, but I failed miserably in Panama when Omar Torrijos was the president. And when we economic hitmen fail, we know that the jackals, the CIA-sanctioned assassins, will be the next step. And in fact, they assassinated Torrijos, as they did Jaime Roldos in Ecuador, another place where I failed. When the jackals fail, as in Iraq, then as a last resort, the military goes in. But as you pointed out, this empire has been built primarily through economics and economic hitmen, not through the military.
You know what fascinates me, John, is that given the fact that this is how most American power is exercised, why is it that the press focuses on the overt military operations that seem to be the exception rather than the rule? Why, in your view, is it so difficult for the general press to inform the American public about how American power is really exerted in the world?
Well, that's a question I'd really like to ask you guys. You're in the media. You know, I was an economic hitman, and now I write books. But I really don't know, except I would say that, for example, my book hasn't been touched by what I would call the mainstream press, the ones that are owned by the big corporations like, you know, NBC, owned by General Electric, or the ones that have to survive on big corporate advertising. My book hasn't been reviewed in the New York Times. It hasn't been covered by the mainstream press. And yet in its first week of publication, it went to number one on Amazon. It's only in its seventh week, it's in its fifth printing, and it's on the New York Times bestseller list. It's obvious that the American people are interested in this, but the mainstream press doesn't touch these kinds of things, and I don't know the answer to that.
Well, they don't know how to sell it. You know, I mean, if it was just confessions of a hitman, they'd be all over it. But, you know, when you have economics in there, a lot of people don't know how to talk about that, and they just, you know, that's how they play to the sort of cultural stupidity of the American people.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think also the word economic seems to be anathema. You know, as soon as you insert it somewhere, people start snoozing, or at least that's what people in the press say.
Well, except the public hasn't, you know.
Yes.
The public snapped it up, but I think what you're saying has a lot of merit, and I think, you know, your other answer, that people kind of understand war and bloodshed and killing, whereas if you try to write for a major newspaper or magazine an article about how economics is used in the world, it becomes very, very dry. It's one of the reasons I wrote this book, very autobiographical, almost like a novel. You know, I mean, I wanted it to read like an adventure story because my life has been an adventure story, and yet it's all completely true, but I didn't want it to read like a history book or an economics book because that puts people to sleep, and I really want people to understand what we're doing in the world today.
Well, that, you know, this is interesting to me, John, is that, you know, this is really, even as somebody who's on the radio, I mean, I know in my heart that this is really how the world works, is what you're writing about. And I think it's a great thing. It's a great service you've done by personalizing it and making it understandable to people like me. And I'm looking forward to reading it because I just think that a lot of people don't realize that this is, as you were saying, this is the nuts and bolts of why, you know, things are so wrong in this planet right now.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. I've traveled around the country, and so many people say something similar to that, that we know in our hearts that this is the way things are, but, it's easy to ignore it until somebody kind of hits you over the head with it. And I'm also struck, I just came back from Tibet and Nepal and England, and I travel a great deal. And in so many of these countries, ones that we call illiterate, people are suspicious. They're skeptical of their government. They're skeptical of our government. But in this country, it's like we tend to accept an awful lot of things that our government says on face value.
We're a little selfish here. I appreciate everything you're saying, John. We got to get out of here. We're coming up on a hard break. The book is Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's definitely a worthwhile read. It's available on morningsedition.com. Thank you for joining us. We will be back with Jeff Jarvis and Mark Danner and more fun stuff after the top of the hour. It's 58 past Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
On Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, liberals of all kinds, and of course I always welcome our few conservative listeners who always like to drop emails around. You know, they're always very helpful. Helpful with their hate.
Gives you things to talk about as well.
And that voice that you don't know is Mark Danner. He's a staff writer of New Yorker Magazine and author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, which is available on our morningsedition.com. You can get that for a little bit of a discount. He's guest hosting while Mark Riley finishes his lengthy two-week vacation in beautiful England. Yeah.
Which is gorgeous now.
Yeah, is it rainy? But, you know, it snowed here.
Probably
this
warmer
morning
than New York.
As you know, there's a horrible a natural disaster occurring, you know, over almost a quarter of the world, it seems. A tsunami and an earthquake have, wreaked havoc on a great many countries. There's close to 20,000 people dead, if not over that now, in Indonesia, India, Malaysia, Maldives, Myanmar, is that how it's pronounced? Bangladesh, and it was felt in Somalia, some 3,000 miles away in Africa. If you want to find out what you can do in terms of aid, you can go to morningsedition.com. We have posted some sites to get involved with that. I guess I can't, you know, earlier in the show I was talking about, you know, how so many people are killed in these horrendous natural disasters. And I guess it was really a bit of, not oversight, but just a lack of understanding that, you know, I just assume that, you know, that structurally, you know, perhaps these communities are, you know, because they're beachfront communities, that, you know, they're vulnerable and fragile. But I guess when it's a 500 mile per hour or 500 kilometer per hour, you know, wave of water, I mean, just about anything's going to go down.
Yeah, I think if one hit Florida, I think you'd lose an awful lot of people.
Yeah, it's just awful.
No matter where it was.
And so go to our website if you want to, you know, figure out what you can do to help, if anything, from where you are, that's available to you at our website. Now, we were talking with the author of this, John Perkins, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and about why a book like that, you know, it doesn't have the popularity that it should, you know. And I was talking to you off mic, Mark, about, you know, just how people respond to, like, I know when I read this stuff, if I read something by Palast, or I read about the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the horrors of privatization and the way that they completely destroy, you know, entire countries, you know, in all aspects, you know, economically, socially, you know, culturally. I think one of the reasons these books are unpopular is that, you know, what can you do? There's a powerless feeling when you really know the reality of how the world works. It becomes very overwhelming. And I think a lot of people don't want to know because they want to manage their denial and work on as small a level as they can within their own sphere. I think most people are by and large, you know, self-centered and just want to write a check to wherever the check will go to help as opposed to activate. And I'm talking about this in light of what we were talking about, the mobilization of the Christian right, and what we were talking about in sort of where's the center of the Democratic Party. I think a lot of it has to do with the same thing, is that how much do you want to get involved?
Mm-hmm. I think it's true. I think it's very difficult, you know, to get into these matters and really try to understand what power is. You know, it takes a lot of effort. And in fact, to go in and read a book like this and other books available on the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank and other rather complicated subjects, you have to make an effort to do that. And you have to make the effort at the same time as you're being sold a very different line of reality in the mainstream press, by and large, that is easier to accept, easier to understand. And part of that, you know, in opposition to Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is the notion that the U.S. gives a vast amount of aid around the world, and most of it is essentially simply charity that represents the good-heartedness of the American people.
Which he was saying is really a lie.
That's right. But Americans, as you just pointed out, want to hear that. I mean, you'd like to hear things that make you feel better. And I think one of the keys to the election was that the Bush campaign, at the same time as it made people fearful, also gave them an answer to their fear. In other words, you create the problem, and that is fear, enormous fear, and you give them an answer. And the answer is George Bush and what he represents and the image they gave him. So they created the disease, and they also gave them the cure at the same time. That's absolutely critical. I think the Democratic Party did not achieve that, basically.
Well, I think what you said, too, which would sort of, like, you know, spark something in my head, and also, you know, your piece, How He Really Won, about the election, is in the New York Review of Books this week. Mark Danner's piece is right there on the cover. In big red letters.
In big red letters, yes.
But what you said that was interesting to me is that it enabled a certain type of person to behave in a morally superior way.
Absolutely.
And, like, because I, you know, one of the big questions that Thomas Frank asks in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, is, you know, and also this sort of, like, how do we get back this religious base? You know, how do the Democrats lose these people? And the truth of the matter is I couldn't understand, you know, everyone's big question is how can these people vote against their own personal economic interests, you know, in and choose ideological interests over that?
Mm-hmm.
And what you just said was pretty crisp, and that's the answer, is that it enabled them to feel morally superior and to feel like they made more of a sacrifice, you know, and that they are the real sort of heirs to this country.
Absolutely.
Because of what they were justified through, you know, they were validated by this president.
Absolutely. And if you feel that you're, when you go to the ballot box and you go to the voting booth and you're standing up for moral values, you're standing up for holding the line on marriage, you're standing up for holding the line on Homeland Security even, which actually became a moral issue in this campaign, it makes you feel good. And I think, you know, I got a letter about the New York Review piece from Andrew Hacker, who's a wonderful sociologist and professor who writes about politics a lot, who said to me, you know, this election was partly about giving people a reason to feel good. And you give them a reason to feel good because you say, look, we need you to stand up for moral values. And, of course, moral values, that phrase, even though it really names things that Democrats stand for and that Republicans stand for, has now come to mean a circumscribed set of issues, you know, banning partial birth abortion, quote unquote, banning gay marriage, that have been defined by the Republican Party. And if you put those forward and say, come and stand up for morality, you're giving people something very positive to do that makes them feel better.
Even though that you know, on the backside, these guys are screwing them.
Absolutely.
On all levels. I mean, on Social Security, on health coverage, on everything else, that the people that are going to be paying the biggest price in the future are these people that think they're morally justified in their decisions.
Completely.
And the truth of the matter is that, like what we were talking about before, you have a president that pays a lot of lip service, but he never says outlaw abortion. You know, he's working these people. He's using them because the questions come up as, like, you know, how much is he willing to do for this particular group of people, these crypto fascist zombie brigades. You know, what is he really willing to do for them? And I think he's playing them.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. If you look at one of the things I point out in this piece is that if you look at the issues, the actual issues, George Bush is very unpopular on most major issues. And in fact, before this election, more Americans disapproved of his performance than approved. More Americans disapproved of his performance in Iraq. A lot of majority of Americans thought the tax cuts were either wrong or did not help the economy. So on issues, forget it. He's not doing very well.
But apparently enough people were afraid that if daddy leaves, you know, then everything's going to go to crap. That, this president, you know, turned so many, it's like an abusive relationship he has with this country. He just kept hitting them with fear, And then, they were afraid to not be hit anymore.
Absolutely. I think that's true. And I think the fear, you know, it's interesting that with the end of the Cold War, the Republicans lost their key issue, which was national security, which is most Americans believe, apparently, that they're more responsible, are better in protecting the country than the Democrats are. And 9/11, the one thing it did was restore that issue to Republican hands, and they recognized that early on from the spring of 2002 when Cheney first criticized the Democrats for criticizing the war on terror, certain decisions that were made. He said, these leaders have made comments that are unworthy of national leaders in a time of war. That was April 2002. Since that moment, they have ridden the national security issue ruthlessly. And I think when you look back at the first term of George W. Bush, there is one thing, one area in which he is an unmitigated success, and that is using the war on terror as a political tool. He was very successful at it. Make people frightened, give them the answer to their fear, and
yeah,
that's him.
And the media certainly helped him out, using the
Absolutely.
Death of 3,000 Americans in a tragic attack to facilitate his next rise to power shamelessly, was what he did. Now, 866-303-2270 is our number. We've got our media guy, Jeff Jarvis, coming on. He's the editor of BuzzMachine.com. He'll be with us at the bottom of the hour, but he's going to talk about his favorite media moments and the most impactful media moments, and we want you to share a couple of yours over the last year since we're coming up on the end of the year. 866-303-2270 is our number. If you want to share your favorite media moments before Jeff gets here, we'd love to hear from you. Mark Danner is here with me. It's 16 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. We can't do it without you. Call us at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Right here on Air America Radio.
Yes, 21 past the hour, Mark Maron. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Did I say it's 22 past the hour? Well, it is. Did I say it again? Mark Danner is with me. He's my guest host today. He is a staff writer at New Yorker Magazine. His book, Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror is available right now on MorningSedition.com for a bit of a discount. How you doing, Mark? You holding up?
I'm doing great. I'm having a great time. I'm going to get up this early every day from now on.
I don't believe you.
I don't. I'm going to change my life.
We're taking calls, 866-303-2270, about your favorite moment in this year's media parade. It doesn't have to. It can be favored for any number of reasons. It could be touching, funny, or just revealing about the media, whatever you want, because you know that's in light of the fact that Jeff Jarvis, our media guy, is coming on at the half hour. Right now I have George Bush's Palm Pilot for today from Raymond in his underpants. 9 a.m. Wake up in Crawford. Day one of grueling post-vacation vacation. Note, vacations are hard work. 11 a.m., make notes for inaugural speech. Note, 6 or 7 minutes should be plenty. It's not like I have to run again. 12 a.m., plan second term agenda. Note, find new fun thing that half of America loves and ban it. Must keep base energized. 1 p.m., call Yushchenko to congratulate him. Tell him the first stolen election is always the sweetest. All right. 2 p.m., make resolutions for 2005. 1, eliminate any residual listening to others, quote, unquote, there. 4 p.m., find out if any Halliburton equipment was damaged in that tsunami thing. 9 p.m., test multi-billion dollar blame defense system. Note, it only takes one to bring this whole thing down. There you go. So let's take some calls. Let's see what people are thinking about the media. You know, you had an interesting thing. Can we go off the check here, Chris, and just take the one at the top so Mark Danner can address this this issue of Ed in Florida. Ed, how are you?
Yeah.
Ed, yeah. What were you going to say?
Okay, let me bring up a few things in one statement, and I'll lock them in together.
First off,
I was happy to hear someone over there, and I just tuned in, mentioned that the Bush administration is using evangelicals.
Yes.
We have to remember, we have a Republican president and legislators.
Right.
They passed a bill against, quote, partial birth amendment.
Abortion, what? Yeah.
Abortion. Why didn't they put in for the, you know, except for the detriment of the health of the mother? They don't want it to go away.
Okay, stop right there and let's address that because that's what we were talking about. Mark, the idea that they don't want to actually, that wedge issues are never to be resolve.
Absolutely. This is, you know, wedge issues. This issue is called by the political term of art is a free issue. Free issue means that you can continue benefiting politically from it without ever having to make the decision that will cost you votes. And abortion has been a wedge, has been a free issue for Republicans now for 30 years. Partial birth abortion, I think your caller, Ed, is right, is partly a way to keep this thing going. The problem is if they ever really had to address it, if you had a Supreme Court finally appointed entirely by Republicans that actually did put an end to Roe v. Wade, the Republicans would suffer electorally because, surprise, if you look at the polls, fewer than one American in five supports outlawing abortion, which was one of the reasons why you didn't hear much about abortion during the campaign. You heard a lot about partial birth abortion, and partial birth abortion is not a medical procedure. It is a political creation. It did not exist before, basically, the Republicans created it.
All right.
Yeah. And it is indeed a free issue. And they've been brilliant at doing this. The Republicans Party has been brilliant for 30 years, really, in developing these issues that pay this kind of dividend.
Didn't mean to cut you off, Ed, but we had to move into these media calls. So shifting gears, Morgan, listening to LIB in Connecticut, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? So what was your favorite moment this year in the media?
By far the watershed moment of gay marriages in San Francisco.
That was very touching.
It was.
It was very exciting. Thank you for sharing that one.
And I was in San Francisco, where I live half the year, when that happened. And the first I heard about it was driving in downtown San Francisco and getting involved in an enormous traffic jam. No idea why. Then finally got close to City Hall, and there was a line of people out of the front of City Hall that went around the block and out into the street. And it tied up these people who were waiting, tied up traffic throughout the city.
Yeah, it was very exciting. I didn't know you spent half the year in San Francisco. So, did you live there?
I'm there from the end of January to essentially the end of the summer.
Oh, I used to live there. That's a beautiful city. Susan, listening in Ohio. Good morning, Susan.
Hey, good morning. I love your show. Listen, that probably should have been my favorite media moment as a gay woman, but I tell you what mine was, is when Bush gave his three henchmen the peace medal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
When he gave Tennant what's the other?
Paul Bremer and Tommy Frank.
I forget their names, too. But, you know, it's like watching that children's fairy tale, The Emperor's New Clothes, over and over again.
Oh, absolutely. All you got to do is do bad for the guy who's in charge, and you get a medal. Thanks a lot for your call.
The great thing about that is it's really a demonstration about how this administration is different than others, even the Reagan administration, to which they're often compared. They basically say, we are going to show you that power can dictate truth. We are going to say that this war was a success, and because we've been returned to power, we can enforce that view. And, you know, think back even Ronald Reagan. You could never imagine him doing something that blatant as to take the people responsible for these rather enormous errors leading up to the war and during the war and during the occupation and rewarding it in that so prominent a way.
And
never
it's
would
shameless.
Have it.
And all they're doing is they're enforcing a reality that they're generating. It's completely
exactly.
Unreal. It has no bearing on the reality that everybody lives in, but they are so committed to it that if you're not part of it and you don't believe it, it's baffling and it's aggravating and you feel like you're in a science fiction movie, man.
Absolutely. It's so true. You know, it reminded me when I watched that, I was thinking of the novels of Kundera, which describe, you know, the reality of living in a regime that enforces truth, and in this case, during Cold War Czechoslovakia, and the kind of nausea that produces. And when I looked at those images, that's what I thought.
That's why I feel weird. It's that nausea that you're talking about. We're going to come back with Jeff Jarvis, who's the editor of BuzzMachine.com, and he's our media guy, and we're going to take a look back at the year's most memorable media moments after this, and more with Mark Danner. It's 28 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, I am Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm sitting here with Mark Danner, who has been co-hosting all day. He's a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. His book, Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, is available on our website at morningsedition.com. Joining us now in the studio is our media guy, Jeff Jarvis, the editor of BuzzMachine.com, and a former TV Guy critic. And we're going to take a look now at some of the high points of media high points over the last year. He's brought his son Jake, is also in the studio. Jake is an observer, a 12-year-old observer. I'm dying to ask him some questions. Maybe we'll get to that. So Jeff, let's just talk about what signifies the media this year. What evolution has the media taken in the last year that you see as being important?
I think we'll look back this at 2004 as the year the people took over media.
Okay,
and,
how so?
Well, you know, the most important invention in media was not really the Gutenberg press. It was the remote control.
Mm-hmm.
Because it started to give us control of our media. We could do the TiVo and the VCR and the cable box. We got to control what to watch. This year, we got to create media.
Okay.
Right? And the people, anybody in the world, anybody in the U.S., in Iran, in Iraq, anybody, can suddenly tell their story to the world thanks to the web.
Right.
And this year, we saw people using that. In years past, it was just to say what you had for lunch and pictures of your cat and all that kind of stuff. This year was about changing the world.
I'm still with the pictures of the cat and things I had for lunch. But, you know, I'll catch up.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the year when you get rid of Dan Rather, that's a pretty big deal. The year when you have an impact on the presidential election, the year when bloggers get invited to the convention. That doesn't mean that they're going to replace big media. But they're a new medium. The people have a new medium.
They were forced to be reckoned with, and a lot of the mainstream media had to deal with what was coming out of the blogosphere in order to, you know, because they broke stories.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's a whole new relationship with the audience. The audience isn't an audience anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
The writers read, the readers write. Everybody gets to play in this.
Yeah.
And big old bad media, yeah, doesn't like that to some extent, but it's a good thing. Suddenly now the people can fact check you and the people can add facts. And last night when the tragedy happened with the tsunami, I went onto the web and there was a Malaysian blogger I met named Jeff Ooi, JeffOoi.com. And, you know, he had immediately links to other bloggers in that part of the world.
Wow.
And I was getting stories from people who were there at beaches and places around the world, what was going on in their countries. Yes, I was getting from Reuters and BBC and the AP as well. But I was getting different perspectives from people.
Yeah.
And that is now possible. Now, that's great for media. It's good news for media. Dan Rather may not say so, but the wise people in media will say, well, now the people can add in and we can all have a conversation.
Do you think the mainstream media takes advantage of this stuff? I'm always amazed. You know, you can get online and look at blogs from Iraq, for example, that'll tell you what is actually going on day by day in Baghdad. But I have no impression that reporters at the Times or Washington Post or anything else not only have time to watch this stuff, but pay any attention to it whatever.
I'm now told, I think that was true a year ago, I am now told that in any newsroom in the country, reporters now read the blogs. They may not admit they get their story ideas from blogs, but they're a fool not to. A year ago, in December, there was a first blogger besides Salam Pax in Iraq named Zayed at HealingIraq.com.
Sure.
And I said, gee, I wish we had bloggers in Iraq because we want to have this more voices. I want 1,000 Salam Paxes. I want to hear what's going on in Iraq. And I fretted about that on my blog. And I got an email out of nowhere from this 24-year-old dentist named Zayed who said, okay, convince me. How do I do it?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you go to Blogspot, next day he's publishing. I sent him a camera a year ago. He covered an anti-terrorism demonstration in Baghdad, warning us, by the way, what was coming here.
Mm-hmm.
New York Times didn't cover it. Nobody covered it. He did. He had tons of pictures. At the time, we went after Dan Okren at the New York Times and said, bloggers did, and said, well, what about this? Why didn't you cover it? And they said, well, we didn't know about it. Well, there are only 3 or 4 blogs. You could have read them. Everybody knew about it. That's changed. I think now a reporter who doesn't know something because it's on a blog is a fool. And I think their editor will say they're a fool. So at the very least, you start to have this input that people have. It's about fact-checking. Ken Lane, a blogger, said famously, we fact-check your ass. It's about adding more information. It's about adding new perspectives. Media always needs diversity, and diversity used to mean hiring. Well, now diversity can mean listening. And hearing all this great stuff out there.
Well, what about a BS filter? I mean, at what point, I understand this, and I'm certainly, I will read whatever is out there and look around, but, what defines integrity, in terms of the type of facts you're getting, the type
right.
of stories you're getting? How do you know you're not being sabotaged? I mean, with the Rather thing, they started, there were speculations on the web from both sides as to, the typeface. That all started on the web. The
18 and a half minutes after Rather was off the air.
Right.
Somebody went along and said, gee, that was funny, and left a comment in a blog. Another guy at Little Green Footballs, who's a graphic designer, went into Microsoft Word, retyped the memo, put it up in an image right over the other one, and said, whoa, it's exactly the same. Right?
But I put that out there. Do you think he was set up, though? I mean, I tend to think that Rather was set up.
I don't think Rather knowingly lied. I think Rather's stupidity came. It's always in the cover-up.
Right.
Nixon, it's always in the cover-up. And okay. I'm saying the cover-up, but afterwards he should have said, thanks. Oh,
right.
Good, let's get to the facts. And he didn't. Instead, he said, no, you're a bunch of idiots, and I'm Big Dan Rather.
Right.
And those days, he built himself a pedestal and forgot to build stairs back down. And those days in media are over.
So let's talk about the integrity question from before in terms of information.
Well, the important thing is that the blogosphere corrects itself.
Right.
Right? Media eventually corrects itself in the long run, but it takes editions and cycles, right?
On page 5 or in 2 issues down the road.
What happens immediately is if somebody makes a mistake, and if it's read,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of trees in this forest that don't fall and no one hears them. You
right.
know, but if it's read, people will correct it immediately, and they go after you and after you. And if you don't correct it and if you don't admit to it, then you become known as a liar.
All right, so your integrity is screwed on the Internet.
Yes.
And that means that if you don't live in that world among your peers, then your word is meant.
Exactly. There was one blogger once who was found to be plagiarizing, and his name is Mud now. He's he's living off in some desert island.
But can he just come back under a different name?
He could. But then he'd be smarter and know his lesson.
Right. Exactly.
So I think that everybody keeps everybody honest here. The complaint about the citizens' media, as I like to call it, is that it's an echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not, because I link to those people with whom I disagree. So I can say, look at this bozo, what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the other complaint is this integrity question of, well, how do you know it's true? Well, how do you know Dan Rather's telling the truth? How do you know anybody's telling the truth? You know because enough people add in what they know that you get to a consensus, you get to some wisdom of the crowd here.
But and isn't that similar in, I don't know why I'm playing devil's advocate with you, but isn't that...
The horns look good on you.
Yeah. Isn't that consensus the same thing that leads to, a complete, breakdown of perception? I mean, a lot of people voted for George Bush. A lot of people believe a lot of things that aren't true. And if enough people believe them, then they are a consensus as well.
There certainly is a willful desire to be convinced of something you want to be convinced of. Swift votes. The whole month, to me, the saddest part of the campaign coverage was that it got down in the end on both sides to mudslinging. And that's what politics is, and I wish we could rise above it, and we apparently can't.
Mm.
So whether it was swift boats on the one side or even, Bush's National Guard service on the other, it really didn't matter to what was going on in the country right now. And too much concentrated on that. And yes, on the web, there was a lot of, well, was Kerry in Cambodia or not? Mm-hmm. And I was screaming about that on the web and complaining about the mudslinging and saying, well, we should stop concentrating on that. And frankly, I then ignored the Dan Rather story. And I said, well, that's more mudslinging. But, and bloggers came after me and said, Jarvis, darn it, you follow media and the Dan Rather story is a story. And I came back and I said, you know, you're right.
All right, so now when we come back, we're going to talk, you know, you can, we can ask you some more questions about that, but also about, you know, your media picks for the year. What were the most important moments? I'm assuming from both mainstream media, maybe secondary media.
The revolutionary media notes.
There you go. So we're talking to Jeff Jarvis, and we will continue that conversation when we come back. It's 42 past the hour, Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
Ask your doctor if Morning Sedition is right for you. Then listen anyway. Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
7 past the hour. I am Mark Maron. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My co-host Mark Danner from New Yorker Magazine, also the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, available on morningsedition.com. Also with us, our media guy, Jeff Jarvis, the editor of BuzzMachine.com and former TV guy critic. We're talking about big moments in the media over the last year. But right now, we know things are tough in the job market, so we've decided to help out. We scanned through the Sunday Help Wanted listings and found this for our Morning's Edition Monday job listing.
Ah, yes.
Security, Secretary of Homeland Security. Please note, this is a reposting of a position previously thought filled. The United States of America, a major enterprise with serious security issues, is still seeking a Secretary of Homeland Security. Recent developments indicate we need to more accurately describe the qualifications for the job. First of all, for purposes of public image, we need someone high up in our organization who can exude a tough guy aura without strapping on a codpiece and prancing about the deck of an aircraft carrier. What we don't want is an individual with any of the following: a history of bizarre stalking behavior, corporate kickbacks, or a multifarious mob connections. In short, we're looking for the type of guy who shaves his head but doesn't do all the other weird stuff that goes along with the head-shaving lifestyle. Oddly, a so-called nanny problem is not a problem at all. If something else about you blows up in our faces, we can use that as a convenient way out. There you go. That's today's job listing. Jeff Jarvis back in the media. Mark Danner has a question that I left you hanging with.
Yeah, I love the optimistic view of the blogosphere, but I also wonder whether all the different voices make it possible essentially to reduce matters of fact to matters of opinion. I'm thinking of the Swift boat ads. You know, you had so many people out there claiming that they were true. That some of the reports, like those in the New York Times, for example, that actually showed that actually most of these claims were false. Those were lost in the general raised voices saying, no, they're true, no, they're not. So it all becomes a matter of opinion. It's as if the fact has been destroyed.
But I think you have to look at citizens' media not as more citizens than media. It's the same conversations you'll hear at Denny's if you ever go there. It's going to reflect what's going on in the country. So, yeah, some people are going to convince themselves and delude themselves of something. That's always going to be the case. But you still have the ability of the links to get to the facts beats previous media.
But the Swift boat ads were effective even though they were based basically on lies.
Sure. But that's always going to be the case. That's more about, you know, in fact, they didn't have to spend any money because big media spread it. Big media had Swift boat all over creation. Big media kept on repeating the ad. They didn't have to buy that time. They kept on seeing it that way.
But the blogs, did too.
They both had a role in it. Both had a role in it.
And the primary purpose, as you were saying, whether it was true or not, was to rip open a cultural wound that had been sort of dormant for quite a few years.
Yeah. I mean, you wonder what would have happened if the blogosphere were around during Whitewater. Mm. Would we have done a better job of saying lay off or pile on? I'm not sure. You know, Bernie Kerik's a little bit of pile on. And the man is no longer a threat to national security. He's a nincompoop. But there's a pile-on going on for the sport of it. And that's the real danger here, is that the sport of gotcha journalism becomes the sport of gotcha media in the citizen's world. And that's dangerous.
I'd like him to pile on more of the bad guys. I mean, yeah, I'd say let a pile on if the guy deserves a pile.
So God help us when President Hillary Clinton makes the first appointments. You know, we're going to get you this time. We're going to get back at you.
Dude, if we get that far,
that's right.
God has helped us already. Yeah. So let's go into some of these media moments that you thought were pivotal.
Three revolutionary moments. Three revolutionary moments to show the future of media. Number one is, of course, the Dean Scream.
Mm-hmm.
Who can forget that moment?
I've seen this song used in so many different ways.
Arizona, New Mexico, and Massachusetts, and it was a great moment. Now, you know, I'm not one of those who believes that the Dean scream was all about poor Dean being put upon because he was playing to the crowd, not to TV.
Yeah.
Presidential candidates always play to TV.
Right.
He was playing a role, as in the campaign, he played a role of, I'm really far left, I'm not central. That night, he was a loser trying to play like a winner.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I think what really happened, the point of this was that the world, through the remixes, immediately made fun of it and immediately said, no, we're going to give you a spin. Spin no longer comes from Spinelli. Spin no longer comes from the spinsters. The world said, this guy's really laughable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what came out. And the remixes, which were a lot of fun, it was about multimedia, you know, muscle flexing in this new medium, said, the spin of the people is, I'm not so sure about Howard Dean. And he became a loser. Now, it wasn't because of the scream. The scream and the reaction just kind of confirmed something. But the point is, for the future of media, after the debates and after all these other events, you went to Spin Alley to find out what was officially happening. Now you can go online within minutes and see what some real people are saying.
But I found myself upset, and I thought that the way that anybody was depicting that, it was being used against a guy in an unfair way. I mean, my gut response, I don't know if it was a collective idea. I think that when you talk about media in the way we're talking about it, you've got to figure out what the line is between, you know, what is real human perception and what is being, you know, sort of coerced by the media.
But that's the point. It didn't come from big media. It came from underneath. It came from people out there who did these remixes, a lot of whom are liberals, too. So they just kind of said the guy's laughable. Dean didn't win among Democrats, let's remember.
But ultimately, it was used against a guy to make him look like an idiot or to make him look like
That's the danger. That's the danger of anything now. You can't control media. Media is not controlled anymore. Media opens up. All right. Number two, of course, is Dan Rather. Number four.
As for the timing of the announcement, as after we decided, we said, well, the sooner the better. And candidly, we also, because we know what the facts are, which are this decision about leaving the anchor chair is separate and apart from the panel's investigation of the 60 Minutes story, which has drawn so much attention.
But to me, he sounds so mournful.
He sounds like he's going to cry a little bit.
Well, perhaps he should. The point there, too, is, all right, so number one is the new spin comes from the people. Number two, the fact-checking comes from the people. The people can add in facts. They can add in reporting. That's what happened to Dan Rather. You look at Abu Ghraib. The fact that somebody's digital camera can produce evidence that becomes a major story, that wasn't the case so easily before. I'm not saying that the people are going to replace reporters. You know, Danny Pearl lost his life reporting on the facts for people. That's always going to be there. But the people can now add into the conversation, and that's what Dan Rather shows. People have something valuable to say.
Right, but that's the interesting thing that you bring up about reporters versus just people sitting at home looking out their window, is that, you know, one of the liabilities of what you're talking about is this great revolutionary front of the new media is that, you know, reporters are guys that go out into the world and risk their lives to get the truth.
Right.
I mean, people sitting at home looking out their window just because they happen to live someplace is not the same thing.
Absolutely not. However, that is not to say that they don't have something valuable to say.
No,
sometimes
right.
It's an opinion. Sometimes it's a fact check. Sometimes it's expertise. It's amazing how you can bring together the wisdom of the crowds here, and you have people who know stuff who now have the means to share it.
But the interesting thing, what I was going to say about Abu Ghraib is it's interesting that, you know, those photographs, they're probably something around 2,000 of them. But they came to prominence through CBS and through The New Yorker as well, I should add. And basically somewhere around 40 of them were published, and everyone was saying for months more would come out. They didn't. They were able, the mainstream media was able basically to limit all of this to a very small number of images.
No. All right, let's get to the other, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Mark, but let's get to the other two things that you've brought with us because we're running out of time.
Right. All right, number three is Jon Stewart on Crossfire.
You're doing theater when you should be doing debate, which would be great.
It's not honest.
What you do is not honest. What you do is partisan hackery. And I'll tell you why I know
Terry on your show, and you sniff his throne, and you're accusing us of partisan hackery?
Absolutely.
You've got to be kidding me.
You're on CNN. The show that leads into me is puppets making.
All right, the important thing about Jon Stewart was, besides it was very funny, and the guys at Crossfire deserved it, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is, at most, maybe 500,000 people saw that on big old CNN powerful network.
I saw it when it was happening. It was pretty.
But you're rare. That was the old days of media. Live is dead now, because in the old days, you saw it, you didn't. You lucked in, you didn't, right? Now, between 3 and 5 million people saw it on the web at iFilm and BitTorrent.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is that the big network is no longer the great distribution means that it was. Now the people's network matters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the future of media now. So you see, look at these three things together. We add in the spin, we add in the facts, and we take over the distribution. That changes the essential relationship of big media to the people. And that's really happened in 2004. That's mm-hmm. really what this year was about. It was about a lot of other things, too, about Swiftboat and mudslinging and other bad things. But the good, I do trust the people. I believe in democracy. And then media became more democratic this year.
Yeah, I just hope that that people still get out and do real reporting. I think one of the fears that I have is that, you know, reporters aren't, you know, they're not encouraged. They don't feel like there's too many careerists within the news organizations. And that, you know, that reporters are essential to really ferreting out things.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. That story about Iraq this year is that reporters can't get out and report it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, thanks for joining us, Jeff. It's great to see you as always. We'll see you in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure. Mark Danner, was great having you on the show.
It's great to be here, Mark. Thank you.
Here's the liberal agenda today from the Streisand compound. One, since you just got a new PlayStation, send your old one to needy kids in the Sudan. That's rough. Two, blame the Bush administration for the sudden high unemployment rate among department store Santas. Three, trim Christmas tree into a topiary protest sculpture. Four, attend a meeting of CCC, Christians Against Christ at Christmas. Sorry, Xmas. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Santa was a black lesbian. You do know that, don't you? Wake up, people. Come on. Wake up. How clear does it have to be? We will be back tomorrow with Kenneth Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History, pro wrestler, and best-selling author Mick Foley will be our special guest host for all 3 hours. Comedian Rick Harris will also be with us. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Jeff. Great to see you. See you tomorrow, folks.